Good morning, everyone, and thank you for that introduction, and more importantly, thank you for coming along and being in this room. It's really great to see so many people together again after the past couple of years. This morning, I'd like to talk about four issues. The first is the resilience of the Australian economy and some of the major uncertainties we face, including those stemming from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The second thing I want to talk about is the journey towards full employment in Australia. The third is the recent inflation data. And then finally, I'd like to talk about the implications of these developments for monetary policy in Australia. Last week, we received evidence of the resilience of the Australian economy. In the December quarter, GDP increased by 3.4%, which is one of the biggest quarterly increases on record. And you can see this in my first chart here. Over the final months of the year, there was a very strong bounce back in household consumption following the Delta outbreaks and the Delta lockdowns in the middle of the year. Over 2021 as a whole, the economy grew by 4.2%, and that's taken the level of GDP to 3.5% above the level it was before the pandemic. This is a remarkably good outcome by global standards, and I think it's something that we shouldn't forget. Australia, the Australian economy has performed very, very well in difficult times. The data available for the March quarter so far suggests a continuation of this positive growth, despite the setback caused by Omicron around the turn of the year. As infection rates have declined, spending and hours worked have both bounced back strongly. The flooding in eastern Australia at the moment is causing very severe disruptions in some areas, and they're likely to continue. But GDP is still expected to increase by around 4.25% this year. This outlook is being supported by the opening of Australia's international borders, by the substantial accumulation of household savings over the past couple of years, by a large pipeline of construction activity that still needs to be completed, and by ongoing support from macroeconomic policy. Against this generally positive outlook, the main sources of uncertainty are COVID-19, which is still not yet behind us, and the tragic war in Ukraine. This war is first and foremost a catastrophic event in human terms, but it's also a new major risk to the global economy. I think it's difficult to know what the full implications are going to be, but from today's viewpoint, the main economic effects largely stem from higher commodity prices. The most obvious of these is the price of gas in Europe, which has more than doubled since the start of February. Oil prices are up by more than 40%, and thermal coal prices are up by a similar amount. These are very, very large increases. The prices of base metals are also up sharply, including the prices of nickel and aluminium. And the prices of agricultural commodities have also been affected, with the price of wheat in global markets up by more than 40% since the start of February. So it's right across the board. It's energy, it's base metals, it's agricultural commodities. Very large increases being recorded. For the countries in Europe, this rising commodity prices represents a negative shock to their terms of trade and thus to their national income. And this alone will cause a sharp slowing in economic activity. Of course, it will also cause CPI inflation to be higher than it otherwise would have been. Australia is in a different position, though, because we export many of the commodities whose prices are rising. Europe imports them, we export them. This means that our terms of trade will rise over the months ahead, which will provide a boost to our national income. This boost is likely to be mainly evident in the form of higher corporate profits in the resources sector and in higher taxation revenues. At the same time, though, the rise in global oil prices means that we'll all pay more for petrol at the bowser. This will eat into household budgets, it will push up business costs, and it will crimp spending in other parts of the economy. Given this, I expect most of this extra national income we will receive will be saved, rather than flow through to higher spending in real terms. Looking beyond the impact on the commodity markets, the war in Ukraine poses very significant downside risk to the global economy, which are hard to specify and quantify. So from both a humanitarian and an economic perspective. There's a lot riding on how things develop here. I would now like, though, to turn back to the more positive story, and that's the resilience of the Australian economy, which is particularly evident in the labour market. At the start of last year, our central forecast was that the unemployment rate right now would be 6%. Yet, as you can see in my next chart, over recent months, the unemployment rate has fallen to 4.2%, and underemployment has fallen to the lowest rate in more than a decade. And we expect these improvements in the labour market to continue. There was a setback in January when total hours worked in the economy fell by 9% as people isolated and some other people took holidays that they'd put off from last year. Looking forward, the very high number of job vacancies and the information we're receiving from our business liaison program both suggest that there will be strong growth in both hours worked and the number of jobs over the months ahead. Our central forecast is the unemployment rate will fall to below 4% over the course of this year, and likely it will remain there next year. As you can see in this chart, the last time the unemployment rate was that low was almost half a century ago, in the early 1970s. If we do reach this milestone, it will be a significant national achievement. This raises the question of what constitutes full employment in Australia in the early 2020s. We don't have a predetermined answer here. We're really being guided by the evidence, particularly in terms of the outcomes for wages and prices. There's a lot of uncertainty surrounding estimates of the NAIRU, and our estimates have trended lower over time as more data has become available. I hope and I expect that a period of sustained economic growth can further lower estimates of the unemployment rate associated with full employment. But time will tell. I was reminded of the changing nature of full employment when last year Michael Stutchbury sent me a copy of the front page of the AFR published back on the 22nd of August 1963. It was almost 60 years ago, and I've reproduced that front page for you here. As you can see, on that day, the paper led with the headline, "Reserve Bank Claims Unemployment Still Too High." Anybody guess what the unemployment rate was at the time? The answer, 2%. Reading the AFR from 1963 served as a timely reminder that what we consider as achievable does change over time, and it is influenced by the structural factors of our economy. I was also reminded, which should also serve as a reminder, that the RBA has three broad objectives: price stability, full employment, and the economic welfare of the Australian people. We've had those objectives since the Reserve Bank Act was first drafted in 1959, and this was a timely reminder of that. My understanding is that the AFR's headline was prompted by the introduction to the 1963 annual report of the Reserve Bank, which was released the day before. From today's perspective, that introduction is remarkable in that it does not mention the word inflation, does not mention the CPI, it just has a vague reference to some notion of price stability. The final sentence of that introduction, though, is more timeless. It's just as relevant today as it was when it was written 60 years ago. So I wanted to share that final sentence in the introduction to our 1963 annual report. It reads, "In the longer run, growth depends on many factors, but with the advance of science and technology, standards of education and the upgrading of skills have become of increasing importance." These words from the past serve as a timely reminder that science, education, and the development of skills are keys to our future prosperity and the keys to future rises in living standards. As Australia charts its way back to full employment, I think it would be wise to keep this council from 1963 in mind. Investment in these areas will also help build the resilience that we need to guard against future economic shocks, wherever they come from. And as we're finding out, it's hard to predict where they're going to come from. but investment in science, education and skills will improve our living standards and help build our resilience. So some messages are timeless. I would now like to move to the other issue of the day, and that's inflation. After many years in which concerns about high inflation are really on the periphery of the radar screen, they've now moved to centre stage, or the centre of the radar screen, in many countries. This is especially the case in the United States, where consumer price inflation has increased to 7.5%. That's the fastest rate in 40 years. Inflation rates in the United Kingdom, in Germany, in Canada and New Zealand are also at the highest rates in decades. Rightly, this increase in inflation is causing a lot of attention. It's important, though, to recognise that inflation rates in much of Asia remain low, and they're not that different from before the pandemic. In China, CPI inflation is running at just 0.6%, and as you can see in this chart, in Japan, it's just 0.5%. So there's a diversity of experience. Australia sits somewhere in the middle, but closer to the experience in Asia than that in the US. Headline inflation here is 3.5%, less than half the rate in the United States, and in underlying terms, it's running at 2.6%. And this is the first time in more than 7 years that underlying inflation has gotten above the midpoint of our target range. Our target range of 2 to 3% is the first time in 7 years it's been above the midpoint. There are a few factors that help explain this difference in inflation rates in Australia and the United States, and I'd like to mention three of these. The first is the different developments in gas and electricity markets. You can see these in this chart. In the United States, household gas prices are up by nearly 25% over the past year, and electricity prices are up by more than 10%. In contrast, the prices that Australian households pay for energy have risen only modestly. Our gas and electricity markets are not closely connected with those in the rest of the world, and the increased investment in wind and solar generation has put downward pressure on the wholesale cost of electricity. A second factor is the different behaviour of goods prices, which you can see here. In the US, goods prices are up by 9% over the past year. In Australia, they're up by just 3%. In the United States, there was a very strong surge in demand for goods during the pandemic, and firms had trouble meeting that demand due to supply chain problems and, in some cases, a shortage of workers. Not surprisingly, strong demand, problems on the supply side, prices go up a lot. The same general dynamic has been at work in Australia, but the surge in demand for goods here was not nearly as large as it was in the United States, and we haven't had the same problem with the availability of workers. A third and a more enduring factor is the different trends in labour markets. In the US and the United Kingdom, wages are rising much more quickly than they were previously, and you can see this in this chart, which compares the current rate of wage growth in a range of countries with the average rate before the pandemic. So in the US and the UK, wages are rising much more quickly than they were before the pandemic. But in Australia, in Japan, and in some European countries, wages are increasing at broadly the same rate as they were before the pandemic. One factor that's contributing to these different experiences is different trends in labour force participation. In the US and the UK, labour force participation is still below where it was before the pandemic. In Australia, labour force participation is around its record highs. Here, the JobKeeper program did help keep workers attached to their employers, and this has helped the labour market recover with fewer strains than has been the case in the US. I think it's also worth noting that participation rates in many Asian countries, including Japan, are still fairly high. So labour force participation has flowed through into wage outcomes, and that flows through into inflation outcomes. The main point, though, I wanted to make here is that while there is a common thread to the inflation story across countries, there are important differences as well, and we need to pay attention to those differences. These differences are relevant to the setting of monetary policy, to which I'd now like to turn. Now that the bond purchase program, yield target, and the new funding under the term funding facility have come to an end, the focus of the Reserve Bank Board's monthly decisions has once again turned to the level of the cash rate. Since the onset of the pandemic, the board has said that it will not increase the cash rate until inflation is sustainably in the 2-3% target range. It's indicated that it wants to see evidence that inflation will be sustained in this range rather than simply forecast to do so. This focus on outcomes and on evidence reflects both the uncertain times in which we're living and the persistent undershooting of the inflation target over earlier years. The recent lift in inflation has brought us closer to the point where inflation is sustainably in the target range. So too have recent global developments. We are not yet at this point. In underlying terms, inflation has just reached the midpoint of the target band for the first time in 7 years, as I said before. And this comes on the back of very large disruptions to supply chains and distribution networks. And some of these disruptions are still expected to ease, which should take off some of the price pressures. It also comes at a time when aggregate wage growth is no higher than it was before the pandemic. And that previous rate of wage growth was associated with inflation being persistently below the target. In these circumstances, we have scope to wait and to assess incoming information and see how some of the uncertainties are resolved. We can be patient in a way that countries with substantially higher rates of inflation cannot. There are two issues in particular that we're paying close attention to. The first is the persistence of the supply side shocks and the extent to which developments in Ukraine add to these supply side inflation pressures. And the second is how labour costs in Australia evolve. Prior to the war in Ukraine, there was some evidence that the supply side issues in the global economy are gradually being resolved. You can see this in this chart. Delivery times had shortened a bit, global car production was increasing again, and the prices of semiconductors had come off their peaks. There was also evidence of businesses responding with new investment and changes in processes to ease the capacity constraints. These developments were providing a basis for expecting that supply-side inflation pressures would ease over time, both globally and here in Australia. But now, the war in Ukraine has added a new supply shock that's pushing prices up, especially for commodities, as I talked about before. This new supply shock will extend the period of inflation being above central banks' targets. This runs the risk that the low inflation psychology that has characterized many advanced economies over the past two decades starts to shift. If so, the higher inflation would be more persistent and it would be more broad-based, and it would therefore require a larger monetary policy response. At the moment, financial market pricing suggests that CPI inflation will decline from its current high rates in the North Atlantic economies to around 2% without real interest rates ever going into positive territory. I think a shift in inflation psychology in our countries would challenge this view. So that's a really critical issue we're watching. The second issue we're paying close attention to is the evolution of domestic labour costs. The latest data did confirm that aggregate wage growth remains modest. As you can see in this chart, the wage price index increased by 2.3% last year. The broader measure, including bonuses, increased at 2.8%. And the national accounts measure of average hourly earnings increased a bit faster than this at 3.3%. The national accounts measure is more volatile than the wage price index as it captures changes in the composition of employment, and we all know those compositional changes have been large over the past year. And we also know that there are larger pay rises than 3% taking place for some jobs across the country. But the evidence is that most working Australians are still experiencing base pay increases of no more than 2 point something. And this is also consistent with what we're hearing through our business liaison program, with most firms planning for pay increases in the 2-3% range over the next year. The RBA's central forecast is that growth in aggregate labour costs will pick up further as the labour market tightens. This pickup is still expected to be gradual, though, reflecting multi-year enterprise agreements, the annual review of award wages and public sector wage policies, which shift slowly over time. There are, however, uncertainties about the future growth in labour costs. This is partly because we have no contemporary experience with a national unemployment rate below 4%. The closest experience we have is that a few years ago, before the pandemic, some of the larger states in Australia had unemployment rates around 4%. And at the time, that did not lead to any pickup at all in wages growth. It was still kind of in the low twos. It's also unclear at this stage what effect the opening of the international borders will have on the balance of supply and demand in the labour market. There's also the question of how wages respond to the current high rates of headline inflation. There is a risk if these higher inflation rates are sustained as a result of a sequence of negative supply shocks that wages growth picks up more quickly than forecast as workers seek compensation for the higher inflation. So we're watching that issue closely as well. But in this uncertain environment, and with the starting points for wages growth and underlying inflation, we can take the time to assess the incoming information and review how these uncertainties are resolved. Given the outlook, though, it is plausible that the cash rate will be increased later this year. I recognise that there is a risk to waiting too long, especially in a world with overlapping supply shocks and higher headline inflation. But there's also a risk in moving too early. Australia has the opportunity to secure a lower rate of unemployment than has been the case for many decades. Moving too early could put this at risk. There are benefits to the economic welfare of Australia of a period of relatively steady growth in which people get jobs, they have training, and they develop their skills through employment. This is one path to sustaining a lower unemployment rate than was thought possible just a short while ago. Not as low as was thought possible back in 1963, Michael, but certainly lower than was thought possible just 5 years ago. I want to finish with the point, though, that it is only possible to achieve a sustained period of low unemployment if inflation remains low and it remains stable. And recent developments in Europe have added to the complexities here. The Reserve Bank will respond as needed, and it will do what is necessary to maintain low and stable inflation in Australia. Thank you very much for listening and coming along today, and I'd be happy to take some questions.
Thanks, Governor, for that address. I'm John Keogh, the Economics Editor of the Australian Financial Review. Good to see you kept dry on the way here this morning, Phil. I wanted to start off by asking you about, for some time you've been talking about wanting to get inflation sustainably in the 2 to 3% band, and that's why you're being patient, waiting for wages to rise. But we're now likely to see, at least in headline terms, inflation get up to maybe 4 or 5% in the next quarter or two because of the surging oil prices and pandemic supply chain crunch. So is there now potentially an asymmetric risk that, as Peter Costello said yesterday, it's very hard to see inflation going below that 2 to 3% band? Alan Joyce is talking about putting airline price tickets up, but it's certainly quite foreseeable over the future to see it going quite a bit above that. And does that need to then change your calculus about when and how to raise interest rates?
Well, I think the risks on inflation have certainly moved to the upside, that's clear. And headline inflation is going to be high. I think it'll have a number with a 4 in front sometime this year as the higher oil prices flow through. The issue we're grappling with is this a temporary increase in the level of prices, or is it a period of ongoing higher rate of increase in the rate at which prices are increasing? And the answer to that's still not known. I mean, it's quite possible that we have a period of high inflation as the high commodity prices flow through, but to sustain that high rate of inflation, we've got to have the commodity prices keep going up. Let's hope that doesn't happen. To sustain the higher rates of inflation, I think we've got to have wages growth above 3%. Let's hope the country can deliver labour productivity growth of 1%. And if it can, and wages are growing at 3, unit labour costs won't be growing at 2, and that's not going to sustain inflation at close to 2.5%. So we're still paying a lot of attention to what's going on in the labour market. Sure, inflation's going to be higher for a while as these supply-side problems wash through, but they may well wash through. And after they wash through, it's really going to be important what labour costs are doing. At the moment, wages in ACRI are still growing with a 2 in front of them. That may change, and one of the, as I said in my prepared remarks, one of the things we're watching very carefully is how labour markets respond to high headline inflation. It's quite plausible, not just in Australia but in other countries as well, that workers looking at high headline inflation rates and a tight labour market start wanting larger wage increases to compensate them for what is, in the United States and in the UK at the moment, a substantial reduction in real living standards in a tight labour market. So watching it carefully, the upside, risk of the upside.
Thanks for that. I do want to get to some audience questions in just a moment. I know Phil's keen to take some from the floor as well, so prepare what you might want to ask the RBA Governor. I'll throw in one more. You told Parliament last month that ideally you'd like to see a couple more quarterly inflation reports before considering raising interest rates. The second of those reports would be in late July, which I guess plausibly makes a potential August rate rise seem quite plausible. But what if you got a really strong inflation report for the March quarter in late April, which seems quite plausible? Could that change your calculus on interest rates? Could you do it without a second quarterly inflation report move?
We don't have a plan that's locked in. We're looking at every month the data that's come in, and since that parliamentary appearance, Russia has invaded Ukraine and commodity prices right across the board have gone through the roof. So when we next meet, we'll have to put all that into the calculus and work out what the next the timing of the increase in interest rates will be. But we don't have a fixed rule we're using here. We're going to look at this complex world we live in and make a decision every month.
By and large, it sounds like you're sticking to your guns on the wages, the labour costs. That's really going to be a key trigger point for the RBA.
It will. I think we can, given the history of low inflation in Australia, we can afford to look through a period of temporarily high inflation because of higher oil prices and commodity price shocks if we think that they will eventually wash through the figures, and then we'll be back looking at what the growth in unit labour costs is. And growth in unit labour costs is still pretty low. So that's still our main focus. Events can come along that shift the focus, but at the moment that remains the focus.
Well, let's turn to the floor. If you'd like to ask a question. Lady up the back, I think it's Lynn Cobley, if I can see her correctly.
Thanks for your speech, Phil. We're just interested, a lot of this conference pleasingly has been around climate change, quite topical with what's happening outside. And I wonder if you can just give us a snapshot as to the work the RBA has been doing in the last couple of years and certainly leading up to COP26 and beyond. I think the audience would be very interested to hear that. Thank you.
Well, there are a couple of things I could pick up. Him and Mark Carney talked about them. The first thing was we were very conscious last year of the views of international investors. Now, every meeting that I attend, Zoom meeting I attend with international investors, people were asking about what Australia's climate change policy was, what are businesses doing, what are financial institutions doing. So I've been very conscious of that, and as a country, we need to have a credible story to tell, and we do have a credible story now. I think we've got endless possibilities in this area, as Mark was talking to, and it's up to business and government to seize that. So that's incredibly important. Through the work that the Council of Financial Regulators are doing, there are two issues that I'm mainly focused on. The first is the importance of disclosure. Capital markets, financial markets can solve lots of problems, but they need information to allocate capital, and Mark was kind of alluding to this. So Australian business and financial institutions, I think, have to do a better job at disclosing their carbon reduction plans, and globally we need a template that people can use to have standardised information that people can trust can read and understand. So that's something that through the Council of Financial Regulators we're working on. I think it's incredibly important because capital markets can't do their jobs if they don't have the information. The other element that we're working on at the moment is the climate risk vulnerability assessments. We're doing this, been doing this with APRA, so that financial institutions understand the risk that they're running from a climate perspective. So Mark kind of spoke eloquently about that, how financial institutions need to understand those risks and they need to disclose them. So it's understanding and disclosure. They're the two kind of key elements of it. In addition to just as an institution, we understand how important it is that Australia remains an attractive place for international capital, and we need to provide the disclosure that goes with that.
We are running tight on time, but I do want to make sure we get one more question from the floor. There's a gentleman up the front here. Just here, and if we've got time, we'll...
Graeme Cartwright, I wanted to just ask about the surge in revenue obviously coming through from those increased commodity prices, and I guess using the language of yesterday, in the mid-2000s, just prior to the GFC, the RBA did put some nuts away on the basis that the mining resources boom was generating excess income. Are we, and I think unemployment got to around about 4%, so not far from where we are now. Does that sort of sway the risks that, you know, we're looking at a mini resources boom, and that's likely to lead to that inflation which did come through in that 2006-07 period?
It's possible that happens, but I think it's quite unlikely, because for that to happen, resource companies would have to decide now to invest heavily on the back of high prices, because that's what happened in the previous resources boom. China demanded a lot of steel, the price of iron ore and other commodities went up, and Australian producers invested a huge amount. The economy was on the verge of overheating because of all the investment income. I think this situation is quite different. It's unlikely that resource companies are going to go out and invest a lot at the moment because of the higher commodity prices. Hopefully they'll invest a bit more, but not expecting a boom. And as I said in my prepared remarks, we're expecting a lot of this extra national income to be saved this time, because resource companies aren't likely to invest a lot. I suspect, I don't know this, but I suspect the governments aren't going to spend a lot of this extra revenue. They'll take it through to the bottom line after having borrowed a lot in the last couple of years. And households aren't going to feel the benefits of the national income. What they're going to feel is higher petrol prices. So they're not likely to increase spending. Investment's not likely to be higher. Government's not likely to spend more. And households aren't going to spend more. So I think most of this extra national income will flow through to the bottom line in terms of national saving. But it could be wrong if the resource companies decide, oh, this is a fantastic opportunity to once again expand the capital base. That could be different, but I don't see that at the moment.
Well, let's do one final quick question up the front here.
Yeah, thanks very much. David Burrow from Stockland. Phil, probably early days, but how is the bank thinking about the floods and the impact to the economy and then subsequently inflation as well?
Well, the impact is kind of obviously catastrophic for the communities, and we're seeing production obviously in those communities suffer, and even here in Sydney kind of there's a lot of dislocation, so that affects the way that many businesses operate as well. So there will be an economic cost to that. We will see higher prices for many fruit and vegetables. The supply chains have been interrupted again, and some of the growing areas have been very adversely affected, so we'll see higher prices for those, which again I think will be evident for a while, but again they should pass through the calculations over time. So I don't see that as a source of ongoing inflation, but it will be noticeable. And in time, there'll be a rebuilding effort. There's already a large pipeline of construction activity to take place in the country. This will add to that pipeline because there'll have to be rebuilding, and hopefully there'll be efforts at more flood mitigation over time. So this will provide a medium-term boost to offset what is obviously a very difficult period right now.